trouble. In this world, you will have trouble. In this world, you will have trouble. Hello, church. Another lovely Sunday morning. I read these words in John chapter 16, verse 33, back in January, and they've been circling around my head ever since. I'm very much hoping that these aren't my life verse for the year, Stephen, before you ask. But these words, they're a promise of Jesus. They're possibly one of the few promises that we're perhaps not so inclined to have on a greetings card, put on a car bumper sticker or a fridge magnet. But no matter how much I would wish that Jesus' words were not so, I do know that they're true. All of us have faced, will face, or are currently facing trouble. Financial difficulties, a wait in a hospital, a relationship that is broken, a redundancy, another negative pregnancy test, the death of a loved one, a home that's been repossessed. The promise that Jesus has made has been spiraling around my head for a while now, before I got asked to do this talk on today's passage. And the question I've been wondering is, how do I respond when trouble comes? So our talk today is based on Matthew chapter 26, verses 36 to 46. It's a scene of suffering. We see Jesus here in agony. He's weeping, face down on the ground. Trouble has officially arrived. Yet his response is one that is so different from my own. So when I was 17, my parents decided that it's time to encourage me out of the house into the big wide world by learning to drive. The day of my test arrived, I was ready. Or so I thought. Turns out, I was one great big sweaty bundle of nerves. I sweated through an entire hour through a t-shirt and a jumper, and my examiner turned to me and said, "Sorry, your first attempt has resulted in a fail." As you can imagine, my brother, my best friends, they responded in love. Buckets of sympathy, great sensitivity. Test two, then test three, produced the same results. By test number five, I was dejected, I was humiliated, and I had made a vow that I was, if I didn't pass that time, going to learn to love the bus. But the experience highlighted how, with only the mildest kind of pressure, I tend to respond in ways that were at best unhelpful when I face any sort of challenge that appears greater than I was. When hurt, trouble, or suffering comes, our tendency can be to revert to habits or behaviors which in fact can push us further into mess. I attempt to deal with it on my own strength, my own plans, my own solutions, my own clever ideas. I deal with my pain, trouble, and shame in secret, in silence. I do my absolute best to hide how I really feel to anyone. I retreat into isolation from others. If I spoke to God during that time as a 17-year-old, my requests were angry outbursts. I focused on pleading with him, create a way for this problem to vanish, make the examiner blind, cause all the traffic in Peterborough to stop, give everybody flat tires. And if it wasn't that, then I was giving God my suggestions, my strategies, and asking him instead to bless what I had already decided on. When Jesus faces trouble and suffering in the Garden of Gethsemane, he highlights a very different kind of lifestyle. It's a very intentional one. So before we dive into Matthew, I wanted to give you four questions to kind of break this scene down. Where does Jesus go? Who does he bring with him? What does he do? And then the slightly more practical bit is, how can we maybe put the lessons of Gethsemane into practice? So keep these questions in mind as we go through the passage. Let's dive in. Then Jesus went with them to the olive grove called Gethsemane, and he said, "Sit here while I go over there and pray." He took Peter and Zebedee's two sons, James and John, and he became anguished and distressed. He told them, "My soul is crushed with grief to the point of death. Stay here and keep watch with me." He went on a little farther and bowed with his face to the ground, praying, "My Father, if it is possible, let this cup of suffering be taken away from me. Yet your will be done, not mine." Then he returned to the disciples and found them asleep. He said to Peter, "Couldn't you keep watch with me even 1 hour? Keep watch and pray, so that you will not give in to temptation. For the spirit is willing, but the body is weak." Then Jesus left them a second time and prayed, "My Father, if this cup cannot be taken away unless I drink it, your will be done." When he returned to them again, he found them sleeping, for they could not keep their eyes open. So he went to pray a third time, saying the same things again. Then he came to the disciples and said, "Go ahead, sleep, have your rest. But look, the time has come. The Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Up, let us be going. My betrayer is here." So a bit of context for those who are not familiar with this passage. Jesus has just shared his final meal and a final conversation with his friends. It's called the Last Supper. At this same meal, he's announced that he is going to be betrayed and he's going to be murdered. These are the very last few hours of Jesus' freedom, and his death is now imminent. Now, scholars have suggested that this is also the beginning of something called the Passion, the point where Jesus takes on the sins of the world and God is turning his face away. When reading this passage through the first few times, you might wonder, why have the gospel writers chosen to include it? There's not much action. Jesus goes for a walk. He gives a prayer. His disciples fall asleep. There's no new teaching here. There's no new parable, no new promise or command given in this scene. In fact, if this was a scene that I was writing, I probably wouldn't have included it. If I'd been making up the story of Jesus, then this is not something I'd have added. We see Jesus' grief. He's distressed, weeping, praying on the floor. He doesn't look like Superman. He doesn't look like a superhero in this moment. Instead, he looks very much like us when we're in pain or going through suffering. Gethsemane emphasizes Jesus' humanness. The fact is that all four of our gospel writers, though, have included some reference to this moment. This scene looks very similar if you read the accounts in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. The writers all want us to notice something then about where Jesus goes, what he does, what he prays in these final hours of his life. His actions in that garden then speak into our lives now and our struggles now. So, one, where does he go? Then Jesus went with them to the olive grove called Gethsemane, and he said, "Sit here while I go over there and pray." You've got a picture of Gethsemane now. Where is the Mount of Olives? It's probably a 20 to 30 minute casual walk from the center of Jerusalem. Gethsemane actually means the oil press, which seems like an apt location for Jesus to choose to spend his last few hours in prayer before he's arrested. An oil press uses high pressure to squeeze and crush the fruit. For Jesus, Gethsemane was a place of high pressure, only hours before his crucifixion. But why here? Often when I read the Bible, I simply nod my head. Of course, I think, Jesus decided at midnight to get up and go to pray in an olive grove. Natural. And I move on. However, Jesus' actions, they're not accidental. They're not casual. They're not unplanned. He's deliberate in what he chooses to do, where he goes, and who he brings with him. Very recently, I decided I wanted to climb a mountain, so I called up my father-in-law, and we agreed on a plan. Got up at 5 a.m., we drove a couple of hours to our starting point, loaded down with the essentials, boots, cake, and more cake, and then we started our climb. And a few hours later, as I got near to the summit, I realized two very, very important lessons. One, my 70-year-old plus father-in-law turns out to be fitter than I was. Embarrassing. Two, early mornings, okay, and climbing a mountain to find a prayer spot. Turns out it's harder work than the idealized vision in your head made it sound. Jesus' disciples, they must have wondered, why had he decided on a midnight hike? Why had he opted to leave the comfortable house they'd been staying in? Why could he not just stay there and pray? God doesn't require us to go to a special place in order for him to meet with us. The effort involved in Jesus' actions then tells us it's deliberate. The Gospel of Luke actually says in chapter 22, verse 39, Jesus went out as usual to the Mount of Olives and his disciples followed him. Jesus was intentional then. His early morning prayer walks were a regular practice. This was not an accident, and it was not the first time that he'd gone out early to find a quiet spot. Jesus has deliberately sacrificed something here that I personally crave: sleep. He's pushed his body, he's denied himself, in order to spend time with his God. When this moment of suffering arrives, Jesus does what he's always done. He takes time out to be with God, to seek intimacy with his Father. Why the mountain, though? The commentaries suggest a couple of different ideas about Jesus and mountains, but the most obvious reason is to pick solitude. Many times, Jesus is recorded as having escaped the crowds to find a quiet space in order to pray. Gethsemane is one of his preferred locations to go for solitude whilst in Jerusalem. In our modern world, finding a place to still our minds and to seek intimacy with God requires intention. Distraction is my own personal enemy when seeking to create a prayer life like Jesus. My phone pings, there's an email dropping, there's jobs to do, there's children, chores. The next series on Amazon has popped up. And for me also, scrolling through my phone for endless hours. Busyness then and hurry, they feel like 21st century inventions, problems for the Western world. But whilst our world might have become more interconnected, the problem of being caught up in other things is nothing new. Jesus knew this. Jesus deliberately, daily, sets aside time to gain intimacy with his Father. He's made a practice out of seeking out a place of solitude to pray in those mornings. I read a book recently by a Christian speaker called Tyler Stanton called Praying Like Monks, Living Like Fools. And he made the point there that in times of crisis, we would like to think that we will rise to the occasion. We like to imagine that when challenge or trouble come, we're going to be able to draw together the very best of ourselves. Instead, the reality is that we fall to the level of our training. In hospital, if you're given the job of being on the cardiac arrest team, then each member attends resuscitation training on at least a yearly basis. The point is that when you're given the cardiac bleep and it goes and you are faced with a patient in cardiac arrest, they revert to their training. This approach is to minimize panic. It's to make sure that the whole team are on the same wavelength. They follow the algorithm. Their response is automatic. Jesus' prayer life in this moment was created out of committed preparation. And in his moment of trouble, he falls back on the practices that he's been following his whole life. A prayer life, a relationship with God that can withstand the very worst moments that life can throw at you, can't just be conjured up at a moment's notice. Jesus' early morning presence on that hillside, praying whilst he knows what is about to come, is the product of long-term intention. 2, who does he bring with him? Jesus does more than just seek a quiet space to meet with God. He was intentional with who he asked to accompany him. He took with him Peter, James, and John, the sons of Zebedee, and he became anguished and distressed, and he told them, "My soul is crushed with grief to the point of death. Stay here and keep watch with me." Jesus' goal in that garden was to seek and to speak with God, but he didn't go alone. He surrounded himself with a community. The gospel writers all tell us that Jesus sought support from his closest friends. Each time after praying, he returns to his friends. They're a source of comfort. He valued their presence, Peter, James, and John in particular. Matthew 26 tells us that Jesus asked them to keep watch with him. What's really interesting to me is that Jesus wanted his closest friends with him, even though he knew that later that night, and then the following morning of his crucifixion, they were going to let him down. They would deny him. They're going to keep their heads down. They're going to run. And yet he valued their presence there in Gethsemane. It's with these three closest friends that Jesus chooses to share just how great his suffering is. He doesn't share this with everyone, but with a select few, he's intimate. So often our instinct might be to pull up the drawbridge, drag down the shutters, to isolate from others when the pain comes. This is not the way that Jesus is demonstrating how to deal with adversity. "My soul is crushed with grief to the point of death," is what Jesus says. The Greek word here, crushed, you could also understand it as besieged, overwhelmed, surrounded, encircled. This pressure that he's feeling then It's all-encompassing. Jesus is physically under strain. Emotionally, psychologically, he's suffering. But most of all, spiritually, Jesus is about to be cut off from his loving Father. When he takes on the sins of the world, when he takes my place, the Father will turn his face away. Jesus will receive my punishment and my judgment. And in spite of all this pain, Jesus, he picks out a few friends and he chooses to be vulnerable. And he simply asks them to stand with him. And because he's invested in his friends, they see his anguish, they see the pressure, they later understand more about his death, how great the sacrifice that he is making. When we open ourselves up and share our deepest fears with a few close friends, we do this for ourselves to gain comfort, but we also do something for them. Spiritual openness with our closest friends helps all to grow in faith. Okay, three. You're halfway through. Keep with me. With all this going on, what does Jesus choose to do in this moment? He prays. Seems simple. The prayer at the center of this whole scene. We've got four verses before, four verses after. It's the climax of this whole passage. Jesus repeats this prayer, and he's doing so under some of the worst circumstances. So we ought to pay attention to exactly what he says. In the Bible, if you're interested, when God says something once, pay attention. If he says it twice, then he's making a really clear point. So are the writers. You really need to focus. So if he says it three times, take it as read then. This is significant. It's worth listening. And when it comes to prayer, Jesus is the absolute master. Jesus' prayer life and how he prayed seems to be what the people who knew Jesus best were the keenest to copy. In Luke 11, his disciples say to him, "Lord, teach us to pray." These disciples, they've been with Jesus now for 3 years. They've eaten with him, traveled with him, they've been taught with him. They mess up all the flipping time, but here, boom, they have nailed it. They don't ask Jesus, "Lord, teach us to preach so that everyone is awed and inspired and they remember this talk for the rest of the year." Moment to laugh there. Okay. "Lord, teach us to perform miracles, signs or wonders. Lord, teach me how to multitask. Lord, teach me how to tell great stories. Lord, teach me how to do dot, dot, dot." The disciples, they recognized that Jesus and everything that he did came out of relationship with the Father. They saw that it's Jesus' prayer life and the way that he prays that sets him apart. Earlier in the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus had got to probably his most famous sermon, the Sermon on the Mount. And in the middle of that sermon, there's a teaching on prayer. It's become known as the Lord's Prayer. So you might recognize the prayer that Jesus gives in the Garden of Gethsemane. The man is riffing off the Lord's Prayer. He went on a little further, bowed with his face to the ground, praying, "My Father, if it is possible, let this cup of suffering be taken away from me. Yet your will be done, not mine." Then he returned to the disciples and found them asleep. And he said to Peter, "Couldn't you keep watch with me, even 1 hour? Keep watch and pray so that you will not give in to temptation. For the spirit is willing, but the body is weak." Then Jesus left them a second time and prayed, "My Father, if this cup cannot be taken away unless I drink it, your will be done." So what exactly does Jesus pray? He falls down on his face and he says, "Abba, Father, Daddy." The start of this prayer, it's relational. In fact, it's shockingly intimate. And Jesus told his followers that we're to copy him. Come to God as if he is your dad. A dad who wants us to ask him, who wants us to spend time with him. It's a reminder that God is about relationship. He's not just some cosmic computer who grants your requests with a yes to all, Bruce Almighty reference. If you haven't seen the film, you've missed out. If you get your prayer formula right, you know, that's not how God works. God wants us to get to know him as a dad. Jesus gives God a title that tells us he's looking for us to simply to spend time with him in relationship. Our Father reminds us who God is, but it also reminds us who we are. Children of God. The first century Jews who heard Jesus' prayer teaching, they would have been scandalized by the intimacy that he's teaching here. Whilst a 21st century Westerner might struggle with the idea of there's a God at all, the first century Jew instead is floored by the idea that you could know God so closely. Next, your kingdom come, your will be done. The pronouns tell you it all. Verse 39, prayer number one. If it is possible, may this cup be taken from me, he says. Jesus is not rejoicing here at the pain and the suffering he's undergoing. He is not delighting in trouble. His prayer is straightforward. It's specific. Please take this from me. He doesn't hide his feelings from God. He doesn't water down his request. This is a prayer that I recognize. This is a prayer that I have prayed. I want God to airlift me out of trouble, to miraculously change my circumstances. I want some divine intervention to take away my suffering. Jesus prayed that. But he's also really clear. Your will be done, not mine. When we come to prayer number two in verse 42, he says, if it is not possible for this cup to be taken away unless I drink it, may your will be done. His language has actually changed. In his second prayer, Jesus submits himself to the will of God. Jesus wants God's will to be done. He's released the attempt to control things his way in any way. He doesn't offer God suggestions, alternative ways that he could do things, and he doesn't ask God to simply bless his plans. He yields himself to God's will. Next, Jesus says, pray so that you will not give in to temptation. How easy it would have been for Jesus to take matters into his own hands. Gethsemane is located right on the boundary of the city limits. Jesus could have walked over that ridge and been beyond the power of the temple guards. He knew his accusers were coming that night. He could have chosen somewhere else to be. Your will be done. The fact is, this scene ends with Jesus' circumstances unaltered in spite of his prayer. On this occasion, our Saviour even knows what it's like to live with unanswered prayer, to have God give a no to our request. Very soon, he's going to be arrested, tortured, and killed. And yet, there is a complete change in this scene, a huge tectonic shift from what we saw at the start of this passage. Jesus has gone from anguish and a crushed spirit. Instead, he now faces his accusers with peace. His circumstances, they haven't altered, but this moment of intimacy with God has changed him from within. He knows he's now aligned with God. So, where's the good news in all of this, Tim? I want a God who's going to airlift me out of suffering. Instead, I have a God who's chosen to parachute into the mess with me. This scene tells me I have a God who may not choose to answer every one of my prayers in the way that I want him to when I ask. But I do have a God who has willingly suffered for me and with me. He knows and empathizes with my suffering. In the children's story, Stories of Narnia, I don't know if you've ever read them, the author C.S. Lewis has this scene from the first book where a little boy, Diggory, has ended up in the magical world of Narnia. Diggory has accidentally stumbled in and he's left behind a terminally ill mum, and he suddenly meets the lion Aslan, who C.S. Lewis has been using as a representation of Jesus. In the story, when Diggory gets to this point, he screws up his courage and he finally asks Aslan for the desire that's been burning in his heart. But please, please, won't you, can't you give me something that will cure mother? Up until then, he'd been looking at the lion's great feet and the huge claws on them. Now, in his despair, he looked up at its face. What he saw surprised him as much as anything in his whole life, for the tawny face was bent down near his own, and, wonder of wonders, great shining tears stood in the lion's eyes. They were such big, bright tears compared to Diggory's own that, for a moment, he felt as if the lion must really be sorrier about its mother than he was himself. My son, said Aslan, I know grief is great. Gethsemane, the crucifixion, and Jesus' resurrection, they don't give us an answer to why we suffer. They don't explain why there is trouble and pain. But it does tell us how God feels about it all. Our God has chosen personal suffering as the means to bring final healing to our whole world. So to come into land, 4, how do we put Gethsemane into practice? I want a prayer life like Jesus. I want to be so secure in my love of God that circumstances can't shake me. Gethsemane suggests 3 practical things which might help nudge us closer and nudge me into God's presence and into a faith that can weather all storms. 1, be intentional. Be intentional in making time to become intimate with God. The 15 and 40 offers a chance to dip your toes into the water, to start building a daily prayer rhythm alongside those moments when you spontaneously turn to God in prayer. During this Lent season, try maybe starting a habit of just sneaking off to spend a minute or moment with God. While the rest of the world screams for your attention, why not spend a moment just enjoying a moment in God's presence? His chief concern is getting to know you and for you to know him. 2, get a community and get committed in it. Find your version of Peter, James, and John. Now, I know that they're rubbish and they fall asleep, but, okay, at the end of the sermon, come and find Stephen, Rob, Ross, or Gary and ask them, demand that they stick you in a community group so that you can eat, walk, and learn together, so that when trouble comes, you have someone that you can trust to just simply stand with you and pray alongside you. 3, when you pray, tell it like it is. Be honest. Don't be polite. Name your pain and your need to God. Focus on what hurts. The Lord's Prayer gives us a great model to hang our prayers on. Start by remembering who God is. Dare then to ask him for his will first and be willing to submit to that. Ask God to bring his kingdom into our world. Ask him to open your eyes to what he's already doing so you can jump in on the action. And then bring your needs to him. Ask him for your daily bread. You can't build trust or relationship with God without asking. We're going to break bread in a minute and share some wine together to remember our God who suffered, who died for us. And as we do, I'd like to suggest that try and sneak the opportunity to speak with God. Tell him about your day, your hopes, your fears, and thank him for what he's already achieved for us. Thank you.
Thanks, Tim.